Whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. Michelle Rosenfeld, here on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant in this case, Mr. Daniel Miller, who is here in the courtroom with me in the front row. This is a case about a timber harvest.
Can you pull the microphone down a little bit?
Certainly. Is that better?
That's great. Thanks.
About a timber harvest exemption under the Montgomery County Code in Montgomery County, Maryland. And Mr. Miller is a logger from Virginia, and the property at issue is a piece of property located in Montgomery County, Maryland. The first point that I'd like to make is that the district court concluded that Mr. Miller could apply, or the timber harvest operation could apply, for an alternative exemption from the forest conservation law. This timber harvest operation was to move forward under an exemption under the code that would allow them to timber certain trees off of this forest on this property. The court needs to understand that there is no alternative exemption for a timber harvest operation. There is an exemption for a timber harvest operation, and if you do not receive that exemption, then you are subject to the full application of the forest conservation law. The purpose of the exemption is to recognize that timbering harvest, is a legitimate commercial operation. It occurs frequently on agricultural property, and it's specifically to allow that commercial enterprise to move forward without having to go through the full review of a natural resources inventory, and more importantly, having to dedicate easements and or property as a condition of obtaining that exemption. So I'm asking the court to understand that while the district court said you don't qualify for this exemption, but you can qualify for another alternative exemption, there is no alternative exemption. He simply misunderstood the application and effect of the forest conservation law at issue in this case. In addition, the district court suggested that the plaintiff didn't submit any case law or other authority to support the conclusion that the operation, the timber harvest operation, includes the people who carry out the operation. Of course, the threshold issue in this case is whether or not Mr. Miller, as the logger part of the operation, has standing to pursue this case in the court below. The exemption does run to the timber harvest operation. It does not run to the property owner. It does not run to the logger or any other individual. The county law defines what a timber harvest operation is, and the timber harvest operation is the cutting and removing of tree stems from a site for commercial purposes. The exemption runs to the operation, not to the individuals. And in fact, all of the defendants concede in their brief that the operation, which is eligible for the exemption, could be applied for either by the operator or by the landowner, that either entity, either individual who participates in the operation could have signed the application forms. The fact that Mr. Miller didn't sign one of the application forms, they suggest, is dispositive. However, the defendants concede that either of them had the authority, actual or apparent authority, to proceed with filing all of the paperwork necessary for the exemption. And there's a practical reality as to why the timber harvest operation would be the one eligible for the exemption. As a practical matter, most landowners who have trees to be harvested don't have the requisite equipment to harvest large trees. They don't have the business contacts to sell those trees. They don't have the expertise to actually undertake the physical clearing of trees. And so the operation of necessity, of practical and economic necessity, generally would include both the landowner and the operator. The district court concluded that Mr. Miller does not have standing to pursue his complaint below. And in making that conclusion, the court relied primarily on the Tazewell case, which is cited and discussed at length in all of the briefs before the court. The Tazewell case involved a property owner who had a contract to sell his property to a buyer, and that buyer had the obligation to obtain the permits for a waste-to-transfer station. The buyer in that case did not obtain the permits, walked from the deal, and the seller, in that case the landowner, filed suit. And the court in that case said the property owner does not have standing to pursue this case. And I submit to the and the district court concluded that Mr. Miller really stands in the shoes of the landowner in that case. And I submit that the facts are very different from the way the court actually applied them. And in fact, in this case, Mr. Miller stands in the shoes of the person who in the Tazewell case would have had standing to sue, and that would be the buyer. Why is that the case? In the Tazewell case, the buyer had the contractual obligation to apply for the permits. In this case, Mr. Miller, the buyer, has the contractual obligation to apply for the permits. In Tazewell, the buyer did pursue getting the permits. And in this case, Mr. Miller did pursue obtaining the permits. He hired a consultant who completed and prepared the paperwork. He paid for the permit applications. He paid the consultant who pursued the applications. After it became clear that the permit was going to languish before the county, his consultant sought administrative relief through park and planning, just as the buyer in the Tazewell case. And finally, Mr. Miller was materially prejudiced in this case. He also physically participated in the application process. He marked the trees. He met with staff at the county. He met with the arborist on the site to walk the site. He was actively involved in the permit process.
Let me ask you this question.
Yes.
Is there anything that would prohibit Mr. Mess from selling that timber today to another person who would apply for the permit and get a permit and harvest the trees and take them off the property? Is there anything that would prohibit today Mr. Mess from doing that?
Or from a contractual point of view?
Any legal point of view. Could he not? Is there anything that would keep him from selling those trees today to another person who would apply for the permit, get it, and come in and cut the trees and haul them off?
Well, I believe that the facts in this case, as we've alleged, would absolutely preclude him from doing that. Our allegations are that the county has refused to grant the timber harvest exemption because the county's master plan seeks to acquire through dedication or easement Mr. Mess's forest for a public park or for public conservation. And that, in fact, that is the motivation for the county's having, for the first time ever since 1992, either sent a timber harvest exemption to the county or denied.
I'm sorry, I'm not following you at all.
Okay.
What keeps Mr. Mess from selling the property, selling the timber to somebody else?
The county, in theory, he could sell it to somebody else, but he could not perfect that. He could not
what?
He could not perfect the sale for the same reason that he cannot perfect the sale with Mr. Miller. Mr. Mess.
Why is that?
Mr. Mess owns a very large piece of property.
Well, why can't he perfect the sale?
Because the county will not authorize a timber harvest exemption.
Let's suppose they do. This guy wants to take some different trees. He wants to take them consistent with the county plan, and the county arborist says, okay, you fit the plan, take the trees.
If the county arborist approved a timber harvest plan, then the sale could move forward with Mr. Miller or with anybody else.
Okay.
However, the county has refused to grant that approval, regardless of how many times and how many ways the trees have been marked.
Well, they've refused it in this context with regard to these trees and the way and the ones that are to be cut and where they're located and what kind they are.
They were initially marked, and then Mr. Miller went out and remarked the trees, and the county arborist refused even to walk the site to verify what alternative trees had been marked.
Okay, let me ask, this is switching gears a little bit, but I want to make sure I understand the facts. Your client had to deposit $32,000 upon the signing of the contract.
That's correct.
As a down payment.
That's correct.
Did he get that money back when the sale of the trees was not authorized?
No, he has not. Both parties stand ready, willing, and able to move forward with the timber harvest, assuming at some point it will be approved.
Okay. Is it your position those trees are his trees, Mr. Miller's trees, now?
It is my position that those are his trees, that he has purchased those trees, and he's purchased the right to harvest them.
Okay. So that contract's still in existence, so to speak.
That's correct.
Wasn't there a time limitation on it, though, that it was extended to a certain date, and after that it had been a time limit
on the contract. It had been extended. Mr. Miller and Mr. Mess have been in conversation. Mr. Mess stands fully prepared to move forward. He's aware of the litigation, and he's awaiting the outcome of the litigation in order for the two parties to move forward under
the contract. But the way the contract's written and the way it stands now, there was a time limitation that has now passed.
That is correct.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure I understood.
Certainly. Those parts.
That provision in the contract doesn't really call for reimbursement at all, does it?
It does not call for reimbursement, and it does not call for reimbursement because neither party ever anticipated that this exemption would not be granted. As a matter of course, a timber harvest operation needs to have an approved sediment control permit, which this one has, and it needs a declaration of intent from the property owner confirming that the property owner does not intend to develop the property for 5 years after the operation occurs. They have both of those things. Beyond that, the third requirement is that the county arborist or a designee approve a timber harvest plan that shows that the plan is not inconsistent with county forest management objectives. There are no county forest management objectives. The record is clear. In December of 2008, the county arborist denied, for the first time, having reviewed and denied a timber harvest exemption, admitted that the county has no forest management objectives. She referred the operation to a website and said, here's an example of what sustainable forestry could mean. And then she referred them to seven additional websites. On February 3rd of 2009, she again rejected the timber harvest plan. And she said, what I really need is for you to fill out the attached form. That email was dated February 2nd. The attached form was marked draft and dated February 2nd, the day before her email. Following that, in March, she again rejected the application. And at that point, she had three quote-unquote standards.
Let me interrupt you again. I'm sorry.
Certainly.
If your position is that there's still a contract that's valid, that's binding, that binds both parties, then your answer to my first question should be no, Mess can't sell it because he's under contract with Mr. Miller.
I apologize. I was thinking hypothetically, not in terms of the fact that the contract was still in play.
I understand.
Wasn't thinking in that context.
I understand. I did hit you out of the blue with that question.
That's okay.
Okay, you've used up your time now, but you've got some time remaining after for
reply.
Okay,
thank you.
Let's hear from Mr. Latner.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ed Latner. I'm here on behalf of the county defendants. The trial court correctly dismissed the complaint in this case because Mr. Miller does not have standing. He doesn't have standing because it was the property owner, Dr. Mess, not the appellant, who sought the permit at issue in this case.
His position is those are my trees. I've bought them. I've contracted for them. I have an unconditional contract. Those are my trees now.
That's certainly his position. I don't think there is any support for that legally in the brief. That was alleged in the brief, but there was no citation of support for that. I would say no, that Mr. Miller does not have a property interest in those trees. I'd say
contracts in there, where as Judge Gregory points out, it's an unconditional sale of the trees.
It is a sale of the trees that is contingent upon the regulatory approvals and the contract. Well, whether it recognizes
where is that provision in the contract?
Well, it says that Mr. Miller will obtain the necessary permits. And whether or not it actually says it in the contract, by law, This requires a regulatory approval. This requires that it either meet the conditions for the exemption or that there be an approved forest conservation plan. But I think that was recognized in the contract because it calls for Mr. Miller to obtain the necessary approvals.
That changes ownership of the trees because it requires approval to remove them?
That is why I would say he does not have. His ownership interest is speculative. It is not perfected. It is not vested. It is not ripe until there is that regulatory approval. Because until that regulatory approval occurs, he cannot harvest those trees. He has, at best, an expectancy.
Do you think he could sell that right?
I don't know. It would be a very... It wouldn't be much of a right because it would be contingent upon some regulatory approval.
Yeah, so he could still sell it, couldn't it? Another person could come along and say, I don't want to be involved in this logging operation, and why don't you buy my right to this? You could sell it.
Conceivably, although I think there was something in the contract that said it wouldn't be assigned. But absent that, perhaps that could be the case. But I seem to recall there may have been something in the contract that provided that the logger wouldn't assign the removal to somebody else. But his interest in that property is a mere expectancy. And more importantly, he has no interest in the permit in this, which is really the heart of the standing issue. Now, the appellant has attempted to recast this the facts to say that, well, the application was made on behalf of a timber harvest operation. It wasn't just made on behalf of Dr. Mess. The record does not support that. The record shows that it was the property owner, Dr. Mess, that made all the government applications and all the filings. Dr. Mess signed the notarized forest declaration of intent and the other documents that he wouldn't develop the land for 5 years. He signed the sworn application for a sediment control permit. The permit was issued to Dr. Mess. He filed the application for the exemption.
But that was required, right? Person involved in the logging operation activity, as it talks about, could have signed it, correct?
He could have, but he didn't. And I think that is what is controlling. I think Mr. Miller could have sought these applications or could have sought them jointly along with Dr. Mess, the property owner, or they could have made clear that this was on behalf of an operation that included Mr. Miller.
The contract made it joint.
But it's the application. It's the application. They came to the government, and it was Dr. Mess that came to the government and sought this application. So it is Dr. Mess who...
What does that make when it didn't require the owner to do so? Now, I'd agree with you if it says owner has to do that, but you didn't require that, correct?
No, the law is written, as laws sometimes are, in passive voice, and it says an operation, a harvesting operation, must have these things in order to proceed.
Didn't say anything about the owner.
No, doesn't.
All right. So now, why couldn't the owner who did sign it be in contract with the person as it was here, and they did it jointly by contract?
He could be and was in contract, but he did not seek the permits jointly. The permits were sought and prosecuted by Dr. Mess. Dr. Mess signed under oath. Dr. Mess alone.
No, you don't follow what I'm saying. Is he did sign singular, correct?
Correct.
But we have a contract that says, obviously, you know that it's an implied good faith on both parties to try to make a contract come to, right? He was under contractual obligation not to do anything to hinder the performance of the contract. So why wouldn't they be in joint?
Because Dr. Miller did not make any of the representations that, Mr. Miller did not make any of the representations that the property owner did when the property owner signed those applications. When the property owner signs those applications, he's making representations under oath in most of the cases. He's making certifications. He is on the hook. He has taken the legal responsibility and put himself out there and said, I will comply with these things. Mr. Miller has not done that in terms of coming to the government and seeking the application. So it is Dr. Mess, the property owner, who is in the unique position of being able to complain about the denial of the application. Not Mr. Miller. Mr. Miller could have been a joint applicant or perhaps even an applicant on his own, but it was...
What would have given him the status to do it on his own?
If he had sought the application on his own.
This is my question. What would have given him the ability to do it on his own? What?
Which, the him being...
A contract, wouldn't it?
No, I'm sorry. What would have given him Dr. Mr. Miller or Dr. Mess we're talking about now?
The tree logger.
Okay, Miller.
What would have given him the authority to sign on his own?
I think he had authority under the record as presented.
He record, could. What in the record would have given him? You don't want to say it, but what in the record would have given him the authority to do so?
Right. It would be the contract. The contract. Could be nothing else. Correct.
The contract.
Correct. But he didn't. He may have had the ability, he may have had the authority to seek this permit, this application, but he did not. And I think standing goes upon injury in fact. Who is the one who put themselves out there, who made the certifications and the application?
Is it injury in fact?
No, I don't. Not to Mr. Miller, I don't think there is.
Standing follows injury in fact.
Right. Injury in fact to a legally cognizable interest.
What? Goodness, you have a contract that's unconditional that says I'm on the hook and pay good American money already, and I have an obligation and a timetable for which to do it. I can't imagine any more clear instance of injury in fact.
Then I would say Mr. Miller should have protected that interest and sought the application along with
Dr. That's a different question than standing. That may go to the merits, and that's why we try cases. But that's to say there's no standing here?
No, I think that is the standing, because he cannot complain about an application that was not granted if he did not seek that application. He had an interest, small I interest. Yeah, he's interested in seeing that this happens. But he did not perfect his legal interest. He did not make the application. He did not sign the agreement, the contract. And the record does not bear out that he has protected his interest in this case.
What's your best case to say that position is correct? The mere having a real interest and an interest in fact, that merely because you didn't sign it, do you have anything to support?
I'd say the Tazewell case that the parties have been talking about, the Seventh Circuit case, illustrates that point. Because in that case, the plaintiff was not the one who sought the permits, so the plaintiff did not have standing. The one who the party that sought the permits would have had standing. So
in that case, didn't it set out who has had to apply for it?
The appellant has suggested that case actually helps him in this case, because in that case it was the party that sought the permit actually had the obligation under the contract to seek the permit.
Exactly.
But I don't think the Seventh Circuit's decision is based upon who the contract placed the burden on. I think the Seventh Circuit decision is based upon who actually sought the permit. The fact that the contract required Kirby, who was the contract purchaser, to seek the permit is all well and good, but what's critical is Kirby did seek the permit, and the plaintiff in that case did not seek the permit, so the plaintiff didn't have standing. The Seventh Circuit didn't suggest that, well, gee, if only the contract had said the plaintiff had the obligation to seek the permits, then he would have had standing, even if it was the other party.
Try to stay away from dicta like that.
Well, I don't think it's dicta. The case, you've only got so much in the case, but I think the case, and it's the closest thing, that's why all the parties are talking about it, I think it really rests upon he who seeks the permit is the one who can complain about, has standing to complain about its non-issuance.
Could Mr. Miller have filed the application himself? And not the landowner?
Conceivably, because it's the operation, and anyone with a sufficient interest in the operation could prosecute the permit. At the very least, he could have been a co-applicant, I would say.
There's no regulation that says it has to be from the landowner.
No, it doesn't say it that way. The law is just an operation must have these things, which is a lesson to all of us in drafting legislation, I suppose. It was the property owner who made the application. It was the property owner who received the arborist denial. It was the property owner that retained a registered forester, Mr. Brumley, to help with the future reapplications. The subsequent applications were made by the property owner's registered forester, Mr. Brumley. As the trial court noted, all the correspondence, all the major correspondence was to and from the appellees was with Mr. Brumley or with Dr. Mess, the property owner, or the property owner's registered forester. Mr. Miller relies upon the actions of his consultant, Vince Berg, Berg Engineering. He says, well, my consultant went out and got the forms and had the property owner sign it, and he notarized those forms. That does not confer standing The legal obligations, again, flow from being the applicant, from signing under oath and being bound by those certifications. There are no legal obligations that flow from having having somebody act as a messenger service or as a notary in this case.
So to follow the logical extent of your argument, you could argue, following your argument, that the landowner shouldn't be able to be an applicant because if you have legally contracted away the logging activity, which is the basis for requesting a permit, then why would you have standing even to apply for a permit that's based on activity, not ownership, but activity?
Well, I think the landowner could, and obviously did in this case, could certainly apply for a...
Well, it had contracted away for the activity.
I wouldn't... Well, no. I would say
why
he's
not?
A part... Because it requires... There are obligations the landowner has to allow the logger egress and ingress.
Let's speak to the landowner. You admitted that, and it says on his face, it's talking about activity. So the activity had already been contracted away by the landowner, so even the landowner couldn't do it.
I wouldn't say the activity or the operation had been contracted away. It's the appellant's argument that the trees had been contracted away.
Excuse me, didn't the contract not only sell the trees, not only say you also have to get the permit, but it also said you're actually going to do the harvesting too?
It does say that.
What is left for an owner then on the activity?
I think I
nothing.
Still...
Nothing. The answer is nothing, isn't it?
No, the owner owns the property and is
he owns the property, but he has nothing left as to activity, and that's the basis for permitting and the request and the receipt of such.
Well, I don't agree that the owner has
a
contract.
Agree with me. I'm looking at the language of the contract and the language of the statute. That's what we go by in terms of a law. It's not
right.
Based on what we think. It's based on an analysis of documents.
I think the landowner can, and in this case, did prosecute the applications.
But then answer my question. What is left of the landowner for activity that he had not contracted away?
I don't think the landowner has contracted. He's contracted to have this activity done, but I would not describe it as having contracted away the activity. Like,
but what's the activity? Name it.
It's a harvesting operation.
What is left that he has not contracted away?
I don't know.
He's contracted the sale of the trees, the process for getting the permit, as well as harvesting. What is left of activity that the landowner has reserved under the contract?
Well, I guess under that logic, then, the only person who could apply would be the logger, then.
Yeah, I'm following you. Right, because that's... But it's, to say this is a lack of standing case turns logic on its head.
Well, doesn't your answer to Judge Gregory's question have to be that the landowner gave only a contingent right, and therefore, should the contract fail for any reason, satisfaction of any contingency, then the landlord necessarily has an interest in that which he contracted away subject to the contingency?
Yes.
You agree with that answer? That's your answer?
Yes.
Where is that in the contract with that contingency?
Well, the contract itself says that the logger will obtain the necessary permits.
That's right.
And by law, the permit, even if not, I think that's an expression of the contingency, but even if it's not, if that's not a sufficient expression of contingency in the contract, the law requires that you get certain permissions before you're able to engage in a harvesting operation.
It has nothing to do with the contingency. Maybe you have to wait 100 years to get it. But the contract speaks to contingency, not the law. Unless there's some intervention of public policy being violated, this is America. We have a freedom of contract. So, where is there some intervention to read in a contingency in a contract that does not speak of such?
Well, I think it does, then. I would turn to the part which says that the logger will obtain all the necessary permits. Obviously, there was a realization that this is not something somebody can just go onto the property and start cutting down trees.
Well, nobody's disputing that. We know that. That's why he was involved in trying to get the permit. You're blaming somebody for what they contracted to do and required to do, and now says they don't have standing. And you have yet to tell me what activity that the landowner has not contracted away.
Well, in this case, I see my time is up. I would ask just in conclusion that this court affirmed the trial court's decision. The appellant has asked in the alternative that he be allowed to amend the complaint to add Dr. Mess as a property owner, and I would urge the panel not to follow that recommendation. The complaint was already amended after the defendants moved to dismiss based on lack of standing. There was obviously an opportunity to amend at that point and add the property owner as a plaintiff, and that wasn't done.
All right, thank you. Mr. McCarthy?
Good afternoon. Jared McCarthy on behalf of the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission. For short, I'll usually just call it Park and Planning or the Commission. The first thing I'd like to note on behalf of Park and Planning is it's clear that we're the entity that overall administers the forest conservation laws in Montgomery County, Maryland. Yet it's equally clear from the briefs and the arguments in this case that nobody has pointed to either an argument in the briefs or a fact of record that establishes the Park and Planning Commission is a causal connection to any injury in fact. So in that regard, we've really just allowed the county to take the lead in the lawsuit here because all of the issues before this court relate to the county arborist, who is a county employee and not related to Park and Planning, other than we serve in the same jurisdiction. To sharpen some of the issues, I think the real question before the court is whether a contingent contractual future interest can establish Article III standing when the property owner has done all the permitting or approval process. And to answer Judge Gregory's question, I think it can't be, and I would not concede that the logger could come in and solely do the permitting process. If you look at Montgomery County Code, and I believe it's Section 22A-5 sub D, there are certain representations, certain factors that the property owner must make in addition to the logger. The property owner must sign a certification that he will not develop the property for 5 years. That's certainly something the logger cannot do. The logger here under contract only has some type of contingent interest in the timber. He cannot represent that this would not be developed.
All right. In this situation, is the contingency implicit or explicit?
I think it's, in all honesty, Your Honor, I think it's explicit in the sense that to harvest these trees in Montgomery County, Maryland, you need the regulatory approval under Section 22A-5. You cannot simply sign a contract with a logger, go in, and clear your property.
How about with regard to his obligation, the obligation between these two parties, the contract they have?
The obligation clearly put the permitting process on the logger, except that's not how the facts actually turned out. And Judge Williams actually went to extensive, I guess, lengths in his memorandum opinion to point out the fact that it was Dr. Mess that had undertaken all the regulatory approvals, and that Mr. Miller seemed to be at best a ride-along. And to answer a question that I think was being raised but not fully addressed, if you do go to the contract at, I think it's Appendix 198, there is a timeliness question here, and it does lend itself to a question of mootness, which is another issue of subject matter jurisdiction that I think this panel can take up sua sponte on its own. In essence, that the harvest was only permitted up and through, I believe it says, December 31st of 2010. We are now almost 10 months past that point, and there's nothing in the record, despite appellant counsel's representations to this court, that the property owner is fully on board with this case. The property owner is ready and able to let the timber harvest go forward. That's not in the record before this court. And before this court, the contract expired December 31st, 2010. So there is that added mootness issue that I think this court should address.
Nothing that contract said expires on that date.
Actually, Your Honor, the harvest, I don't have it right in front of me.
It has 18 months to do the harvesting.
And then there's an addendum, Your Honor. If you go to Appendix 198, the addendum says it extends the harvest from up and through, I think it's December 31st, 2010. There is nothing in that contract that permits the harvest of those trees past that point. And I guess the real question is whether there is a vested interest, whether Mr. Miller, as the logger, has any type of vested interest in those trees. And it's clear from the definition in the county code of what a commercial harvest is that those trees have no value until the point when they're actually, the regulatory approval is given, they're cut down, and somehow shipped off to be sold. I mean, the simple fact is, until he actually is able to remove the trees from the property, there is no vested value. And that's the other thing that Judge Williams...
part of the land until they're...
Exactly,
separate.
Your Honor. And Judge Williams clearly addressed that, in the light of the discretion awarded to the county arborist, that Mr. Miller could have no expectation that his permit would be granted, that he would be entitled to harvest those trees, and that, in fact, the discretion destroyed that intrinsic property right, that there is no vested property right. In closing, Your Honor, I think the court really got it, Judge Williams got it correctly, that Dr. Mess was a necessary party. For whatever reason, on a tactical basis, he was not joined. He should have been. There was an opportunity to do so when the first amended complaint was filed. He was not. Appellant should not be given a third bite at the apple. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Rosenfeld. Ms. Rosenfeld, if for whatever reason your client can't cut those trees, does he owe the money, contract price, to Mr. Mess?
I believe under the contract, the way it's written, he does. There is no right of rescission under the contract, and it's not written as a contingent contract. In fact, if you look at Appendix 139, the contract itself says the purchaser shall obtain all permits needed for this operation. It is patently clear that the parties understood that they were seeking a timber harvest operation and the exemption pursuant to that. How does an operation work? It's a partnership. It's essentially a partnership, a de facto partnership between the property owner and the logger.
How can he own the trees, though, until they're severed from the land?
He has paid.
He has a contract interest in the trees, but how can he own them until they're severed from the land? As a matter of real property law.
As I believe at this point, he cannot sever the trees, but I do believe that he has an ownership interest. For example, he could lien those trees for such time as in the future if they were to be removed and sold. So he
that
could lien that property
his interest. His right to harvest them, but not to his ownership of the trees as long as they're affixed to the land. What principle of real property supports your position that a contract for timber harvest conveys an ownership interest in trees while they are still affixed to the land?
Your Honor, I don't have an answer to that question.
But the same ones that would deal with crops, they are affixed to the land too until you harvest them, aren't they?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And their contracts deal with crop and ownership. I mean, the question was, I know you didn't brief this, but there are plenty of situations where growing vegetation, and a tree is vegetation, although it's rather permanent, but it's still vegetation. There's contract laws involved in that, in terms of ownership. You're not prepared to address those, but there certainly are.
He certainly, I think, has a possessory interest in those trees. At this point, should they be removed from the property, he would have an interest in those trees. The county and commission both try to go to great lengths to suggest that Mr. Miller was not involved in the permit process itself. First, as a matter of law, he had the obligation to obtain the permits. The extent of his participation, frankly, I think is irrelevant. However, I think they also overlook the extent of his involvement in that permit process. The county talks about correspondence that went to Dr. Mess as opposed to Dr. Miller, to Mr. Miller. That is inexplicable given the fact that the contact person on the application form itself was Mr. Vincent Berg, who was the consultant to Mr. Miller. He's the consultant hired by Mr. Miller. Why the county chose not to send correspondence to Mr. Miller's consultant and his contact person is inexplicable. In addition, Mr. Miller did sign the compliance agreement for the Standard Erosion and Sediment Control Plan for forest harvest operations in Appendix 148. It is a joint document whereby the landowner and the operator both agree to abide by all of the terms and conditions of the sediment control permit on the property. I also briefly would like to refute Mr. McCarthy's statement that we have not asserted that there's any causal connection between Park and Planning's conduct in this case, that our complaint is directed solely toward the county arborist and the county defendants, and that absolutely is not the case. The record contains an email from a park and planning staff person to the county arborist that says, and I quote, the master plan status and the imminent partial threat to the resource the commission is looking to acquire. Park and planning can move fast at achieving another form of equity for Mr. Charles Mess that does not involve a managed timber harvest, end quote. Park and planning had a direct and immediate interest in whether or not these trees were timbered, because park and planning and the county have adopted a master plan that says scores of acres of this forest are to be placed in conservation easement or dedicated as parkland to the county. And for the first time ever, park and planning referred this timber harvest operation to the county arborist for review. The county forest conservation law was adopted in 1992. The county has conceded that this is the first time that they ever have taken a look at a timber harvest operation at the county arborist level. Finally, in looking at the Tazewell case, the county has strenuously argued that it's who signs any number of these documents, not who had the legal obligation to obtain the exemption. That is not the standard for standing before the federal courts. Standing does not turn on who signed the documents, but on whether the plaintiff has suffered an actual injury in fact. Is there a causal connection between the alleged wrongdoing and the injury? And can the court offer a remedy? And I submit to the court that Mr. Miller has been injured, in fact. He has a contractual interest, a non-contingent contractual interest in harvesting these trees. The question was, what's left for Dr. Mess, the property owner? What's left for Dr. Mess is to collect the balance of the money owed to him under the contract. All of the other rights and responsibilities under this contract are left to Mr. Miller to carry out. Is there a causal connection between the alleged wrongdoing and the injury? Of course there is. Either Mr. Miller has an unperfected contractual obligation here in that he cannot move forward with the timber harvest that he's supposed to carry out, and thereby is injured in his inability to profit from his timber harvest. And can the court offer a remedy? Of course the court can offer a remedy. The remedy would come either in the form of an order directing that the timber harvest exemption be granted or that Mr. Miller be awarded monetary damages. Should we be able, in either case, should we be able to prove the merits of our underlying case? I ask that you reverse the decision of the lower court, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I'll ask the clerk to adjourn court, and then we'll come down and greet counsel.
This honorable court is adjourned for tomorrow morning at 8:30. God save the United States and this honorable court.